This episode is brought to you in part by the Acceleron BioAg brand. Harness powerful crop solutions using technology derived from nature. Products from the Acceleron BioAg brand are bioenhancers, primarily containing live microbial organisms. The products help promote increased nutrient and water availability for better yield potential. Acceleron BioAg product offerings are available for canola, wheat, corn, soybean, pulses, and more. Visit AcceleronBioAg.ca for product information and to view BioAdvantage trial results from growers like you. Nature, it's powerful technology. Always read and follow label directions. Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, we hear from the Western producer's Robert Arneson about the realities of dairy farming in Wisconsin.
She kind of lost a bit control of her emotions and kind of teared up for a few minutes.
Kelly Green of the Canadian Canola Growers Association talks about the Canadian Farm Writers Federation meeting held recently in Winnipeg. And Ashley Robinson of Commodity News Service Canada reveals what's going on in the markets.
Fresh has been in the headlines definitely a lot for a while.
That's all on Between the Rows with this week's host, Ed White.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, your host this week. It seems like we're talking about dairy all the time these days. It's with good reason. The life or death of NAFTA might hinge upon how Canada and the U.S. resolve their differences over supply management. But we spend so much time talking about the situation in Canada that we seldom look under the hood of the U.S. system to see where all the antipathy to the Canadian system is coming from. The Western Producer is in the middle of a two-week exploration of the dairy situation in the U.S., and one of the reporters involved, Robert Arneson, joins me now to talk about the project. Hello, Robert, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Hi, Ed. Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So you're based in Manitoba, and you've gone south. Barb Glenn of the Lethbridge Bureau also headed south. Tell us where you went, what you did, and what you saw.
Well, in the middle of September, I went down to Wisconsin, to the western part of the state, a town called Chippewa Falls. And earlier in the month, Barb went down to Idaho, where she met with dairy producers down there. So when I was in Chippewa Falls, I met with several dairy farmers, mostly small-scale producers who have about, say, 100 to 130, 150 cows or so. And I guess as an example, I met a couple. Their names are Matt and Mandy Nunez, and they actually grew up on dairy farms in California and then ended up in Wisconsin. And the things were going quite well for them. They raised four daughters on their dairy farm in Wisconsin. But about, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago, they decided, well, it's time to invest in a couple of robotic milkers. And they actually built themselves a new barn. So they didn't disclose how much money they spent, but, you know, a significant amount of money they invested in their dairy. The problem, though, is that at that time, all of a sudden, dairy or milk prices crashed in the U.S. around 2015 and remain low today. They're kind of in the range of about $15 to $16 per hundredweight for hundredweight of milk. And at that price, they're just not profitable. They're not making money, and therefore they can't pay down the debt that they incurred to invest in their barn and invest in their robotic milkers. And when I visited with them on their farm, you could definitely see the financial strain on their faces. And, you know, both of us have gone to a lot of farms, and you kind of see how people do things. And they look like the type of people who are very organized, highly efficient. Everything there is kind of neat and orderly. So it's not a case of that they're not trying to cut costs or find ways to be efficient. It's just that with milk prices as they are, they essentially, you know, are not making money. And when you're not making money, obviously you cannot pay down debt. And then at some point, you know, the people that loaned you money, the bank or whoever, is going to call you, right? And I think, you know, there's a lot of people in a similar situation across Wisconsin who maybe got into debt, took on a loan or whatever, and they just can't, you know, get by day to day, right? They're just struggling. And across Wisconsin, if you look statewide, the numbers are really quite staggering. They're apparently losing about 2 dairy farms every day. And that's according to a person I spoke with the Wisconsin Farmers Union. And Wisconsin, I believe, in 2010 had about 13,000 dairy farms. As of September this year, there was about 8,300.
Wow.
So a massive decline in a period of about 8 years. And I guess the expectation is that that's just going to continue.
So what's it like meeting with these people? They must be under a lot of stress. What do they seem like when you spend time with them?
The Matt and Mandy Nunez, at one point in the conversation, she kind of lost a bit of control of her emotions and kind of teared up for a few minutes when we started talking about the next generation on her farm. Would somebody take over? And, you know, it just became clear at that moment that, you know, she wasn't sure if they were going to make it, right? If there would be a next generation or, you know, perhaps their, you know, their children are not interested in the farm. But regardless, it's pretty unusual for somebody to start crying during an interview. That's unusual. And then I met with another producer. Her name is Vivian Thompson, and she's from a town east of Chippewa Falls, and again, another small producer, about 100 cows that she milks with her husband. And she's in her late 50s, and in her immediate area, she told me that 7 dairy farms had gone out of business in the last 2 months. So she's just sort of wondering, okay, how much longer can we hang on? And she told me that, you know, she's not really sure what the future is for the two of them on their dairy, because it seems like, you know, the writing's on the wall that, you know, there's the financials and the economics of being a dairy farmer, small-scale dairy farmer in Wisconsin just don't make a lot of sense. So she too, you could kind of tell that there was definitely, you know, points in the conversation we were talking where she got emotional and had a hard time talking about the situation.
I know we talk about this as journalists sometimes, that one thing that's great about the work we do is we get to go beyond the stats and the policy discussions and actually go meet the real people involved in situations. But another issue we debate is how accurate a picture we're getting, because you can't go and meet thousands of people. You're going to meet, you know, a dozen, something like that, and that's where you're going to get a sense of something. So how do you, in your mind, do that with something like huge and sprawling like the U.S. dairy industry? How do you get a sense of how representative your people are?
So when you go into something like this, you call as many people as possible, and, you know, in reality you end up talking to people who are available, right? Because they said yes. But, you know, you don't want to just tell their story, because, as you said, they don't necessarily represent all of Wisconsin's dairy industry. So what I try to do is, you know, reach out to agricultural economists, some journalists, other people to provide sort of a broader perspective of what's happening within the Wisconsin area and also the neighboring state of Minnesota. I also was able to talk to a larger dairy farmer in Minnesota who has around 800 cows, which, you know, is not huge for the U.S., but would be very large for Canada. So he kind of provided the perspective of a larger producer. But you are correct. You know, at the end of the day, it's difficult to get the totality of the picture. I tried to reach out to a mega dairy. So in western Minnesota, there's a company called Riverview that operates 9 barns. And in those barns, they have 60,000 dairy cows. So a very large company. It's actually a family-run business, run by a group of family farms. And I asked them for an interview, and I asked for a tour of their barn to kind of provide their perspective on what's happening in the U.S. dairy industry. They considered my offer but declined. So again, you know, all you can do is ask, right? and you end up talking to people who are willing to talk to you. Right.
You did, though, get some pretty interesting and, I think, revealing stats from Minnesota, right next door, which is also a heavyweight in dairy production. And I think you were able to get a bit of a sense of the difference between the bigger guys and the small guys and how they're doing for profitability. It was pretty interesting.
Yeah, so as an example, this 800-cow dairy farmer who's in western Minnesota or central Minnesota, his name is Pat Luneman. And what he told me is that, you know, it's hard for him, even at his scale, with 800 milking 800 cows, to compete with these mega barns that have 4,000, 5,000, 8,000 cows. And the way he kind of explained to me is that if you look at it, it all comes down to the cost of production. So these large farms with 7,000, 8,000 dairy cows, they can get their costs down to, say, like $14 or $15 per 100 pounds of milk, whereas a small-scale farmer with, say, I don't know, 150 or 200 cows, you know, their costs are more like $17, $18 or maybe higher per 100 weight. And so obviously when the prices are around 15 or 16, they're losing money, but the big guys with these massive herds are still profitable. And beyond that, you know, if you look at some of the University of Minnesota stats, which kind of track dairy farm profitability, I'm just going to look at my computer here just to kind of make sure I get this correctly here. So in 2014 was a really great year for Minnesota dairy farmers. The median, so that's sort of in the middle of all the list of different dairy farms, the median income or profitability was $142,000, so quite good. And that's a typical dairy farm in Minnesota has about 200 cows. So a 200-cow dairy farmer is making $140,000 in profit. Since then, in 2015, 16, and 17, the median net income for all Minnesota dairy farmers was $43,000, $28,000, and then again $42,000 in 2017. So obviously, you're making 1 year $140,000, and then a couple of years later, the median income across the state is $28,000 for dairy farmers. So I mean, at $28,000 in profits, you're not, you know, obviously paying off a lot of bills or doing well financially. And of course, there would be a lot of dairy farmers who are making less than that. You know, might be making $5,000. In profits or losing 10,000, right? I mean, of course, the medium, as you say, represents the point of halfway, right? You know, so people above that are making more, people above that are making less, right? So,
yeah. Well, this is fascinating stuff, and there's a lot more about this in the Western Producer, both the issue last week and the issue this week. Thanks for joining us today, Robert, to unpack this all for us.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad to be here, Ed.
Robert Arneson is a reporter with the Western Producer, and he is in Manitoba. Manitoba has a lot of cool things going on in agriculture. Agricultural journalists and communicators were just in Winnipeg and rural Manitoba checking it all out. Kelly Green was one of the key organizers of the Canadian Farm Writers Federation's annual meeting in the PEG, and she joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Kelly, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about the conference.
Well, last week in Manitoba, the Manitoba Farm Writers and Broadcasters Association hosted about 150 farm writers from across Canada, from almost every province in Canada. And it's an event that happens every year in Canada, and we had the opportunity to host it this year. The last time we hosted it was 6 years ago. And it's really a chance to bring agriculture journalists and communicators together to spend 3 days learning about agriculture and highlighting agriculture in the province of Manitoba, and also to celebrate excellence in our industry in terms of agriculture journalism and communications.
So what did you show them?
Well, this year the theme for the conference was the changing faces of agriculture, because it was really about what are the significant shifts happening in agriculture, but some of the small things going on as well. So We had four major themes for the conference. The first one was about changing landscapes. The second one was about the changing faces. The third one is about changing diets. And the fourth one was about changing communications. On the changing landscapes platform, we dove into sustainable beef production, grasslands management, and regenerative agriculture. And we also looked at how value-added is changing the landscape in Manitoba in industries like pork, potatoes, the protein industry. For the Changing Faces platform, we looked at issues like intergenerational transfer of farming operations and the contribution of foreign workers to growing our agriculture sectors. And we also looked into labor shortages and what the long-term implications for agriculture on the farm, in the processing plants, and in the offices in terms of what's happening with labor shortages and what we can do about that. The Changing Diets platform, that really was about the convergence between what we grow and what we harvest off of our farms and how that affects human health and our diets. So functional foods was a large portion of that platform. And then changing communications, we looked at how new technologies are impacting how we learn about agriculture, so things like virtual reality. And we also looked at what are the consumption patterns of communication vehicles for agriculture stakeholders, and including farmers. Sorry, I think I've lost my voice from last week.
A lot of fun. There's a lot of talk, I can imagine.
There was a lot of talk.
But, you know, you folks, and I was there for probably two-thirds of it, you folks didn't just talk about these themes in a hotel conference room. You actually made the effort of getting people out there and into kind of a hands-on set of situations.
Yeah, that's one of the unique things about the Farm Writers Conference is we have an entire day of tours where we send people into the fields, onto the farms, into the pastures, into the labs, to actually get hands-on experience and talk to the people who are making these changes. So we had one tour that went all the way out to Brandon and made stops along the way, stopping in pastures and looking at sustainable rangeland management. We had another tour that stopped at a vegetable farm at Portage La Prairie and went out to Neepawa to look what's happening there in terms of value-added processing with pork and with barley. And then we had another tour that stayed in Winnipeg and really looked at, was in a lot of labs, looking at what's going on in medical research and functional foods research in terms of how we can improve diets for consumers. So we had a very busy day on Friday, seeing a lot of Manitoba. In the past, we've often stayed close to Winnipeg, so this year we got people on the bus really early and sent them to see some new areas of Manitoba that farm writers hadn't seen before.
You know, what I thought was neat was even for locals like me, you know, as a Winnipegger, I was getting to see some stuff that, you know, even though I cover agriculture all the time here for years, I haven't seen. Like, I've never before been in the old home ec building at the U of M, and which is now, you know, revamped into a different department and is doing some pretty cool food testing. I thought that was neat. I'm wondering for you, you're local too. Did you come across things that you found interesting?
I certainly did, and I'm not originally from Manitoba, so I constantly learn new things about agriculture in this province. So I would say one of the big things that we were hoping everybody to learn, and something I always learn about, is how broad and diverse agriculture is in Manitoba. You know, from agriculture and grains and oilseeds to vegetable production. For me, I was on the tour in the city, and I did learn probably more than I've learned before about food and health and diet and what we're growing on our farms, how that's contributing to diet. So whether we were speaking with people at the Richardson Center for Functional Foods, or we were at the St. Boniface Hospital Research Center learning about work that's going on in terms of how products that we grow on our farm, whether it's bison or canola or flax, is impacting our diet. So that, to me, was really, really exciting.
And what did you hear from the non-locals about what they either found most surprising or most interesting? What I guess, were the big revelations for them from this exposure to Manitoba ag?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I think if you asked anyone who was here, they might have a different answer. We have so many people who come to this province, probably having been to Winnipeg before, and I think that they each one would have a different experience. People who are on the grasslands tour talked a lot about how sustainable grassland management is really, you know, something that they hadn't thought about when it comes to Manitoba before. The people who went on the tour to the vegetable farm, probably a lot of them have never seen that many carrots before being harvested. You know, that's a pretty big change or something new for them. And I think the tour in Neepawa was really interesting for a lot of people because the community of Neepawa has really experienced a lot of change with the impact of bringing foreign workers to their community to work in their pork processing industry. So that was a really interesting story for people to learn about. So I think there's really something for everyone, and everyone had an amazing experience. One of the things in Winnipeg that farm writers saw for the first time when we were here 6 years ago, the Canadian Museum for Human Rights was just under construction. So this year we actually got to take them to the museum and learn a lot about human rights as well. So it was a very fulsome 3 days for people.
Well, it was a fantastic conference, and thank you very much today, Kelly, for coming on Between the Rows.
Thank you so much for having me, and congratulations on your award as well, for weekly press reporting.
Hey, thank you very much. Bye, Kel.
Bye.
Kelly Green was co-chair of the Canadian Farm Writers Federation Conference and is also director of communications at the Canadian Canola Growers Association. Now for our markets update. We are joined by Ashley Robinson of Commodity News Service. Hello, Ashley, and thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hello, Ed. Thanks for having me.
So, whatever happened to $500 canola?
Well, that kind of sounds like a distant memory right now. We've been seeing a lot of course, the trade news down south and then losses in the soybean market. So canola's been kind of going down, too, because of all that. For parts of the week last week, there was the November contract with NOLA was hanging out around the $485 per ton mark. But it's kind of gone up now, and I see this morning it was around the 490 mark, just above it, actually, which is a bit better. But any of the traders I was talking to last week were kind of saying that it'll just keep going down. They say it's due to the fact that canola is quite high priced compared to other oil seeds, which should just mean that we should be seeing it coming down and that we shouldn't really expect a rally in the market until maybe after harvest.
And there's been a bunch of snow on a lot of the prairies. What is that doing to the markets? What's happening out there?
Well, that's the thing that's kind of keeping the market a bit higher than it should be with all the snow that we've seen. And, of course, Northern Alberta's been making most of the headlines because they got the snow first. But then, of course, I'm sure everyone saw on their social media this week across Saskatchewan and into Western Manitoba, there was snow also. But I heard that most of that's gone now, thankfully, although it was looking like a beautiful winter wonderland. But so that's been limiting losses because there's concern about how the harvest is progressing across the prairies. The last few crop reports that have came out from Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta have shown slowing down harvest progress with, during the week, the harvest only going up by a few percentage points and nothing compared to how we were chugging along beforehand. So there's concern, especially in northern Alberta, about whether that crop will get off. I hadn't checked the Friday crop report from Alberta, but I know the one before was showing a very, very small amount of canola harvested in that province.
And the markets have been juggling a lot of recent USDA and StatsCan numbers. In the end, how did those sets of numbers affect our outlook?
Well, what we're seeing from the USDA and StatsCan is that we're going to have a bigger than expected soybean and canola crops this year, which has been weighing on the market. Although the USDA report, it's always people believe the USDA more than they believe StatsCan, at least according to the traders. So that's definitely had more of an effect on the market than the StatsCan report did. But last week we got what is a relatively new report from Statistics Canada. They do out a satellite imagery report, which they gather how much crops were planted based on these pictures that they take from space. And according to most of the traders, they're not completely sold on it yet, so it didn't have as huge of an effect on the market as you would think when you saw this larger-than-expected canola number come in.
And whatever happens, you know, with our crops up here, we're really profoundly always affected by what's going on in the U.S. So what are the big factors down there right now that are sort of laying a baseline for which our crops trade off?
Well, of course, trade wars and harvest. So last week we saw the intensity between the U.S. and China heat up. Up until then, we kind of maybe been thinking we were going to see a happy ending between the two, at least according to the headlines. We were seeing a lot more headlines saying that China and the U.S. were willing to talk and that China was going to the U.S. to talk about trade relationships. But then last week, the U.S. Threw a curveball into all this happiness and put down some more, placed some more tariffs on China, which, of course, China wasn't impressed and fired back with their own tariffs. And so that sent the soybean market into a downward swing. And then, of course, also, same as here in Canada, we're paying attention to harvest down the U.S. The crop progress reports are coming out every Monday from the USDA. And then last week, the soybean harvest was hampered because the U.S. has been seeing some of the wet weather the same as us. So it was held back last week from where it should have been.
And a lot of people are talking now about Russian wheat exports. What's the big deal there?
Well, Russia's been in the headlines definitely a lot for a while when it comes to wheat, as most of Europe and Asia has been lately. Of course, across most of the summer, we are seeing headlines about the drought in Europe and into parts of Russia, which was going to limit production numbers from those countries. And so at the start of September, we were hearing reports from Russia that they might limit their wheat exports due to a smaller crop. However, the government met with grain traders, and they decided the grain trade was stable and they wouldn't be limiting exports. However, lately they've stayed in the headlines because wheat exports have fallen from the country due to the Russian ruble, the money for Russia, strengthening and making Russian wheat less desirable. So we're going to be definitely paying attention to what's going on with Russia and their wheat exports, because that can have a huge impact on the market and where we see prices go, because there's been a lot of years where Russia's just, especially in the last few years, they've become a really wheat powerhouse, and they've kind of taken over a lot of markets that we've seen places like Canada and the U.S. in before.
Whole world of stuff going on. Thanks very much, Ashley, for joining us today and taking it apart.
Thanks for having me, Ed.
Ashley Robinson is a reporter with Commodity News Service. That's all for this week, folks. Join us again next week for another edition of Between the Rows. Good luck harvesting if you still have crop in the field. I'm Ed White.
Today's program was brought to you in part by the Acceleron BioAg brand. Acceleron BioAg products harness the powerful technology of nature to release soil-bound nutrients, helping promote nutrient availability at the plant root. Accelerate crop performance with powerful bioenhancers aimed at promoting nutrient and water uptake and improved yield potential. Nature, it's powerful technology. Always read and follow label directions. Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.